should you get the swine flu vaccine? Surveys have shown that fewer than half of American adults are certain that they'll get it. Commentator Douglas Camero is a family physician and former assistant surgeon general, and he says getting the vaccine is a no-brainer.
Public health authorities at the federal, state, and local levels are clear in their recommendations. Virtually everyone should get the new swine flu shot, with precedence given to those at increased risk of infection and complications. So, first in line to get the vaccine are pregnant women and those who live with or take care of children younger than 6 months of age who can't be vaccinated. Then come health care and emergency services workers and young people from age 6 months to 24 years. Also people who are older than 24 with diabetes, asthma, or other diseases that make them high risk. Finally come all of us healthy, middle-aged, and older people. Given these straightforward recommendations, why wouldn't you want to get this vaccine? First concern. Some people are afraid the new vaccine isn't safe, hasn't been tested enough, they rushed to make it too quickly. I don't want to be a guinea pig. Wrong. This new vaccine was made the same way, with the same ingredients, at the same factories as regular seasonal flu vaccine, which is an extremely safe vaccine. There has been no evidence of harm or serious side effects in the vaccine trials that were conducted, and the worst you can expect from the vaccine is a sore arm for a day or two. Second concern. Why get the vaccine when everyone says the new flu is a mild disease? A few days, a little cough, a little fever. And I probably won't get it anyway. Wrong and wrong. While it's true that most people who've gotten the disease have not been seriously ill, people under age 50 have no immunity to this virus, which means it's very infectious. And when you have a lot of people infected, and we're talking tens of millions here, then some of them are going to get very sick, get hospitalized, and even die. It's happened in many states already. Young, previously healthy people and pregnant women are dying from the H1N1 swine influenza, and that's big news. Related to the last concern is the opinion that there's no need to get the vaccine because you can just take one of the antiviral medicines to treat your flu if it gets bad. Wrong. While it's true that so far we have antiviral medicines that are effective treatments for swine flu, they need to be reserved for severe cases, or for people who are at increased risk of becoming very ill, like those with asthma. If everyone starts using them, the flu virus will likely mutate to become resistant to the medicines, and we're in big trouble. Finally, some people say they can't afford the new vaccine, especially if they've already paid for the regular seasonal flu vaccine. Wrong. You've already paid for the vaccine in your taxes. The federal government has bought all the vaccine and is giving it away. The most you'll pay is an administration fee, and many people will pay nothing at all. Bottom line, the new H1N1 swine flu vaccine is safe, effective, cheap or free, and necessary. Unless you're allergic to eggs, when this vaccine becomes available in your area, make sure you get it, and make especially sure your kids do too.
That's our commentator, Douglas Camero. He's a former assistant surgeon general and a family physician. He lives in Maryland. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. The other day, deep in Rego Park, Queens, in New York City, Stanley Moskowitz and Walter Israel sat down at a Formica table for lunch.
Top liver.
Okay, liver appetizer.
Yeah.
Moskowitz, who's 53 and grew up in nearby Forest Hills, ordered first.
Matzo ball, tip of the tongue, roast beef, rye, okay. Russian, okay. Onions. Dr. Brown's Diet Cherry.
We are at Ben's Best Kosher Deli on Queens Boulevard.
Pastrami, rye bread, black cherry.
That's Walter Israel. His son Jason was also there.
Jason, you know what you have it? Hot pastrami. White bread.
Pastrami on white bread. In this defense, I should add that Jason did not ask for mayonnaise. But this combination, pastrami on white, enjoys a certain status as the epitome of the faux pas in Jewish delicatessen shtick. David Sachs, the writer who introduced me to Ben's Best and who is on a mission to save and celebrate the Jewish delicatessen, quotes the late comedian Milton Berle.
Anytime someone orders a pastrami sandwich on white bread, somewhere a Jew dies. So maybe it wasn't the cholesterol that was killing everyone. It was other people ordering pastrami on white with mayo. There are certain rules that you should follow in a delicatessen, and they're not there to be strict, and they're not there to dictate what you should do. They're there for your own good. This is a meat that's so intensely flavored with such a long and intricate preparation that to dilute it with anything other than mustard and rye bread is to take away from it. There, lettuce and tomato and mayonnaise don't belong on it because it detracts from all the sensations that this meat is going to give you.
What about a club roll?
There, you know, a club roll is sort of that borderline of acceptability. An onion bun might be as well. You could get away with that, possibly. I think that's it. Those are sort of the borders. You're really pushing the edges there.
David Sachs is a 30-year-old writer who grew up in Toronto, eating food from Yitz's Deli and hearing stories about the Jewish delis his parents knew growing up in Montreal. Speaking of the Milton Berle joke, Sachs begins his new book, Save the Deli, with another rumination on delicatessen food and human mortality, the story of how Grandpa Sam Sachs met his untimely end.
Legend has it, because this happened 2 years before I was born, that my grandfather had been treated for angina, and he was supposedly released from the hospital with a stern warning from the doctor saying, you know, you really have to live better, you can't smoke, you can't eat these fatty foods. And so to celebrate his release, he went to Schwartz's delicatessen in Montreal, a famous delicatessen, and he got a...
Shea Schwartz, now in the, right. Under the new language regime.
Exactly. And he got a sandwich piled high, a smoked meat sandwich piled high with speck, which they no longer make, which was the fat cut from the top of the brisket, the pickled fat, dusted in paprika, and then grilled, and then re-sliced. So it was a sandwich essentially of pure fat, and he died about a day or two later. I mean, you know, the sandwich did him in, but he died in a mustard-soaked blaze of glory.
Moral of the story, it ain't health food we're talking about.
It ain't health food, but it's not poison either.
David Sachs has traveled across North America in search of the best examples of that endangered culinary species, the Jewish delicatessen.
A Jewish deli should specialize in, first and foremost, Yiddish foods, the foods of the Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews. So if it's a place that specializes in pizza or chicken wings or diner food and then does a corned beef sandwich on the side, it's not a Jewish delicatessen. There are many places that serve corned beef and pastrami sandwiches from Subway to the supermarket, and they don't factor into this at all.
Ben's Best factors into this very centrally. It is a rare surviving example of a once thriving breed, the neighborhood deli. Tourists who go to New York's Times Square may hit the Carnegie Deli and the Stage Deli, but they don't schlep out to Rego Park in Queens. Ben's Best is also a kosher deli. No ham sandwiches here, no Reuben sandwiches either. They don't mix meat with dairy. David Sachs says this is one of the last kosher delis in the borough of Queens. And as we squeeze in with the countermen who are busy slicing and wrapping lunches, Sachs talks about the matzo ball soup and the stuffed cabbage. He points out the pickles and knishes like a docent in a museum or a jeweler huddling over a display case.
Here we're in the Holy of Holies. This is the meat counter. So we have dried salami, which is salami that's been hung to dry, kosher salami, a meatloaf, roast turkey breast, roast beef, pickled tongue, which is harder and harder to find these days. Is that rolled beef? Do you guys have rolled beef today? Oh my God. Okay, we're in for a huge treat. So rolled beef is one of these things that was once ubiquitous at delicatessens all over New York. It's basically the navel, which is the same cut of pastrami, but they butterfly it. They spice it like a pastrami, but they roll it up and tie it with twine, smoke it, and then slice it thin cold. It's the rare truffle of the Jewish deli meat world. We're all in good.
And when somebody comes in and orders it, we know they know. That's like the secret deli handshake.
That's Jay Parker, who owns the deli. He took it over from his father, Ben, after a career selling municipal bonds. It's a small place, 15 tables, with a big takeout trade. Jay Parker says in a good week, he sells more than 800 pounds of pastrami. We feasted on some of it, and it was delicious. So was the not-too-hard and not-too-soft matzo ball in the chicken noodle soup, the silken slices of tongue, and the much-anticipated rolled beef. Deli food certainly enjoys a celebrated past, but I asked Jay Parker, does he see a future for it?
That's a great question. Don't have an answer to that. I usually ask people that. I said, you know, we all talk about pastrami, we all talk about corned beef, we all talk about these items, but they've never become part of the social fabric. You go to any neighborhood, you can find an Italian restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, a Thai restaurant, a Mexican restaurant, sushi bars. But it's an interesting question. I don't have an answer for you, but I think about it every day.
And for David Sachs, this deli, like other survivors in cities all over the country, is something more than a restaurant and something more than just a cause for nostalgia.
It's the repository of this edible culture in the city where this culture really grew up.
David Sachs, his book is called Save the Deli, and he thought that I contributed a fairly apt slogan for his very entertaining one-man crusade. A world without heartburn is a world without heart. A few days ago, we asked you to send us stories about your favorite delicatessen, and we received lots of them, stories of delis still in existence and others long shuttered, and we've collected them at our website, npr.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. If you've bought prescription drugs recently, consider this. Medication is the third most expensive item in our healthcare system. It's about 10% of what we spend overall on healthcare, and it was about half that much 30 years ago. Today, NPR's Elise Spiegel looks at one thing that's been driving this change: television advertising.
Ann Nissan is a 17-year-old student who lives in Prescott, Arizona. David Cooper is 49, a career counselor based in L.A. And then there's Samantha Severi. She's 26, works in Baltimore, Maryland, a transportation planner. Three very different people in three very different places whose stories all begin the same way, with a couch and a television.
I remember sitting on the couch.
We were watching Jeopardy.
On my sofa, probably a rerun of House.
So there they are, in Arizona and California, in Maryland, enjoying a small moment of peace away from school and work and life. And then out of the darkness, at a slightly increased volume, comes the message.
The commercial begins with a yellow and green landscape.
A little creature who sort of jumps up and down, kind of vaguely evil.
It looked like it was a party setting up on a rooftop. You know, big city type of thing. And the narrator started talking about symptoms that some people struggle with, including constipation, diarrhea,
fungus,
PMS, and the cramps and everything.
And then it says, you can take this drug and everything will be fine.
You see, David had been struggling with this infection on his toe and had terrible cramps. And Samantha found herself rushing to the bathroom at odd times. Then suddenly, right in front of them, the answer.
It stuck in my mind.
That's exactly what I need. I think it made me feel hopeful.
There was just one more thing that Anne and David and Samantha needed to do. One more hurdle between them and salvation. To solve their problem, they needed a prescription.
So then I went to my doctor.
And then we just went to my doctor. So I made an appointment with my doctor. Just basically said, look, I really want to try this. I brought up the name of the medication.
This wonder drug.
And do you think it would work for me? If so, you know, hit me up.
Today, the average American gets 12 prescriptions a year. In 1992, we got on average 7 prescriptions a year. That's a 58% increase, which costs American society about $180 billion more. Now, there are more medicines on the market today than there were in 1992, but researchers think that around 20% of that $180 billion increase has absolutely nothing to do with the number of medications available or the cost of that medication. What does it have to do with? Direct-to-consumer advertising.
Okay, my name is Joe Davis, and we're in Vermont, Wilder, Vermont. I used to be wild, and now I'm wilder.
Joe Davis is retired now, but in his speech and manner, it's easy to hear the breezy salesmanship that made him so successful. Davis, you see, was an ad man.
I was trained, or I was toilet trained, as we like to say, in packaged goods. General Foods, Procter & Gamble, this kind of thing.
Now, some history here for context. Until very recently, the 1980s and 90s, the kind of people who sold stuff like packaged goods were really different from the kind of people who sold stuff like prescription drugs. Drug ads were designed by people who worked at these small, technically-minded medical advertising companies. Companies that only targeted this small, technically-minded audience. Drug ads, says Davis, were for doctors.
Nobody had ever thought that these drugs should be or could be or would be advertised to the consumer or the patient because they thought only doctors could understand the products, their technical products.
But really it was more than that. There was this fear shared by doctors and drug companies alike that advertising drugs directly to consumers could be harmful. Because though consumers couldn't really evaluate whether or not a drug was appropriate, they might become convinced by an ad and then pressure their doctor to prescribe it. Also, it might disrupt the doctor-patient relationship. See, at the time, the doctor-patient relationship was mostly a one-way street. Joe Davis tells this story about his own mother, a sophisticated woman who Davis found fumbling with a bottle of pills one day. Davis says he asked what she was taking.
Well, she said, I take a yellow pill, a green pill, and a white pill. I say, that's great. What are they for? Well, she said, I don't know. Why do you take them? Well, the doctor told me to take them. So it was very passive from the patient's standpoint.
So doctors decided what to prescribe, and drug companies, through medical advertisers, tried to influence doctors. But, says Davis, the system wasn't working out well for the drug companies.
The whole problem with this system is, that it's very slow.
Even though drug companies spent an enormous amount of time and money trying to change the prescribing behavior of doctors, that process often took years. And because of patents, the amount of time companies had to make money off their products was limited. And so Joe Davis, the man from packaged goods, contacted this guy named William Castagnoli, then president of one of the larger medical advertising companies, and the two came up with a solution.
Why not talk to the patient and have the patient go in and ask the doctor for the drug and pull it through the system?
Problem was, this was almost impossible to do. At the time, the early 80s, FDA regulations required that when drug ads included both the name of a drug and its purpose, side effect information must also be included. But side effect information could take mountains of mouse print to catalog. Here's Castagnoli.
In the newspapers, it would take up a whole page.
But, says Castagnoli, there was almost no way to make it work on television.
Because we couldn't scroll the whole disclosure information over the television screen, okay?
But then in 1986, while designing an ad for a new allergy medication called Seldane, Davis finally hit on a way around the regulations. After checking to make sure the FDA wouldn't object, here is what they did.
We didn't give the drug's name, Seldane. All we said was, your doctor now has treatments that won't make you drowsy. See your doctor.
This was one of the very first national direct-to-consumer television ad campaigns, and the results were nothing short of astounding. Davis says before the ads, Seldane sold about $34 million a year, which was actually considered pretty good.
Our goal was maybe to get this drug up to $100 million in sales. But we went through $100 million, and we said, holy smokes. And then it went through $300 million. And then it went through $500 million. $600 million. It was unbelievable. We were flabbergasted. And eventually went to $800 million.
Pharmaceutical companies clearly took note. Today, drug companies spend $4 billion a year on ads to consumers. The regulations now permit TV drug ads to name both the drug and what it's for, as long as major risks are disclosed. And the Nielsen Company estimates there's an average of 80 drug ads every hour of every day on American television. Julie Donahue is a professor of public health at the University of Pittsburgh, and she says those ads clearly produce results.
Something like a third of consumers who've seen a drug ad have talked to their doctor about it. About two-thirds of those have asked for a prescription, and a majority of people who ask for a prescription have that request honored.
Now, whether the increase in the number of prescription drugs taken is good or bad for patient health is an open question. There's evidence on both sides. What's not up for debate is this. By taking their case to patients instead of doctors, drug companies increase the amount of money that Americans spend on medicine. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Now to a strange controversy in Egypt, and we should warn you that it involves some explicit physical description. A company is advertising a device that claims to simulate virginity. Conservatives are not happy about this. As NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Cairo, the device highlights a double standard in Egypt when it comes to premarital sex.
The online ad from Gigamo.com promises women no more worry because they can restore their virginity for just $29.95. The ad says the product fits in the vagina and upon penetration oozes a blood-like liquid. Add a few moans and groans and you will pass through undetectable, promises the Asian website in its somewhat mysterious English. Virginity is a very real issue for Egyptian women, as illustrated in the popular film The Wedding, released earlier this year. It's the story of Abdullah and Gamila, a young couple who signed their marriage contract years ago but couldn't afford the marriage ceremony that would, by tradition, allow the union to be consummated. The couple has been having sex all along, and after gossipy neighbors call Gamila a tramp, her father warns Abdullah that the following day he must prove to the whole neighborhood that Gamila is still a virgin. Complications ensue. In Egypt, those women who can afford it may resort to surgery to restore their hymens before their wedding night. But news of this new, inexpensive device sparked an intense backlash. A lawmaker from the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood said it would be a mark of shame on the government if it didn't keep the devices out of the country. An unscientific sampling of opinion on the streets of Cairo found widespread acceptance of a double standard which is hardly restricted to the Arab world. Purity applies to women, but not men. 19-year-old Ahmed Rafat says no matter how much he loved a girl, he would drop her instantly if he found out she wasn't a virgin. Then he was asked, well, shouldn't it be the same for a man?
No, it's not a big deal if the guy's not a virgin. I'm not speaking about Islam. I'm just saying it's normal. But she has to be a virgin because she's a girl. She's a girl. That's just the way it is.
Sitting next to Ahmed is his cousin Aya, who laughs at Ahmed's logic but seems resigned to the prevailing view that forgiveness for premarital sex is a one-way street.
For me, men and women are the same. The only reason he said it's normal is because he's a guy. But I would never marry a guy who wasn't a virgin. Well, maybe if we were really in love and it was just once and he was honest about it, maybe I could forgive it.
At the offices of Enigma magazine, Egypt's upscale fashion and society monthly, managing editor Amy Mouafi has heard all this before. She's the author of the popular column and now best-selling book, Female, that's F-E-M-A-I-L, The Trials and Tribulations of Being a Good Egyptian Girl. Mouafi says Egyptian men still have a huge complex about virginity, from the poorest rural villages to the wealthiest Cairo suburbs.
No matter how Western he may appear, it's very exceptional to find a man who is willing to accept a woman who has had, quote-unquote, a life before marriage. And the objective, unfortunately, for an Arab woman remains marriage. I mean, there's a quote I often use, is that as an independent Arab woman, you can break as many glass ceilings as you like, but you can never break your hymen.
Mouafi has her own issues with these artificial virginity devices because she doesn't believe technology should be a substitute for confronting hypocrisy.
And the problem with a device like this is it makes it too easy for the woman to play by the rules of society instead of standing up and saying, no, you need to understand that I am a good person and it should not all come down to this issue of an hymen.
The owners of the website did not respond to questions, so it's not clear if any artificial virginity kits have actually been ordered from Egypt. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Cairo.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And here's a development, or a banking innovation anyway, for the developing world that's now catching on in the United States. It's a microfinancing website called Kiva.org. It lets Americans make loans to struggling entrepreneurs across the globe. Recently, the website extended its service to American small businesses who've been having a hard time getting credit. NPR's Charlotte Baer reports on one of those businesses.
Tanis Lee Harrison stands on her tiptoes to reach the top shelf of a client's laundry closet. She's ready to scour filthy corners with her homemade cleaning solution and acrylic nails. Yet even after 3 years of owning a housekeeping business, she wasn't prepared for this mess.
Oh my God! Oh my God, this is not... This isn't even funny.
Harrison never thought she'd be a cleaner. The 47-year-old was desperate when her husband's notary work dried up. Her family of three was barely getting by in East Palo Alto, California.
That's when I had called a friend of mine and said, do you know anyone who needs anything done? Because I really need to, I'm going to lose a house. So she said, well, my mom's in Stockton, if you don't mind going there. And I said, sure. I found out later Stockton's like 3 hours away.
Harrison says the work poured in. She had to hire an employee, buy heavy-duty vacuums, and find extra storage. But she couldn't get a loan or even a credit card. She'd emigrated from Canada and didn't have a credit history in the U.S.
I did try to get credit through places like Walmart or something like that. I didn't get it from there. I didn't get it from the bank because my Social Security number is so young, I have no credit. There's nothing there.
Then she heard about loans on the Kiva website. The site connects small business owners who need cash with internet users who want to open their wallets. The potential investor can loan as little as $25. Within a single day, nearly 80 people fulfilled Harrison's $2,000 request.
It's another growth spurt for me, very personal thing to me. I think I'm going to tear up.
Microloans typically have low interest rates and easy payback terms. Harrison will pay hers off in $100 monthly installments. Kiva just recently made these loans an option for U.S. borrowers. The San Francisco-based organization thought it might help the economy in its own backyard.
We know that small businesses are kind of the cornerstone of the economy. It's a real growth driver of the U.S.
That's Premal Shah. He's the president of Kiva.
Even before the credit crunch, small business loans were hard. Post-credit crunch, it's really, really hard. Kiva really started thinking about, wow, you know, we're allowing people in the developing world to be able to request loans. Why not uncrunch America and, you know, let people here in the U.S. request loans and see if the internet community wants to fund them on Kiva?
A small number of lenders protested the decision. Tom Behan was one of them. He says Kiva's mission is to alleviate poverty, so it should disregard the U.S. since it's the richest country in the world.
There are over 2 billion people in the world who live in extreme poverty. Poverty is, as defined by the U.N., trying to get by on less than $2 a day. And it also means they don't have access to basic necessities that we do here in the U.S., like free education, free health care if you need it, and the services of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, of social and religious and nonprofit groups that are dealing with every kind of need.
Behan and other unhappy lenders are switching to a different organization. That won't change Kiva's course. According to Premal Shah, Kiva has attracted more money since U.S. loans began, and he says that's good for entrepreneurs all over the world. Charlotte Baer, NPR News.
Just before President Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, we met a man who has yet to receive that honor. Ernie Banks says he always wanted the prize. He wants it even now, as we're about to hear. Banks was one of the greatest players in Major League Baseball. He made the Hall of Fame, even though the World Series, like the Nobel Prize, always eluded him. He played for the Chicago Cubs.
Every year, I always looked at spring training as a brand new year. And I didn't think about what happened in the past. I was thinking about new ways for new days. and I couldn't wait to get to spring training.
The other day, Mr. Banks came to Washington to open a conference on baseball at the Library of Congress. We found him at his hotel and brought along an old tape.
Well, here it is, Tuesday, May the 12th, 1970, and Ernie Banks comes to bat with two out and nobody on in the Cub half of the second inning against Atlanta.
We played that tape for Ernie Banks, and a smile spread across his face. He knows this play. He remembers standing in the batter's box, and as he listens, he knows exactly what's about to happen.
Jarvis fires away. That's the fly ball. Beat the left. Back! Back! That's it! That's it! Hooray! He did it! Ernie Banks got number 500!
His 500th home run.
Everybody on your feet! This is it!
All these years later, at age 79, Ernie Banks rises to his feet. He throws his strong arms over his head in celebration. And across the hotel lunchroom, people applaud, as if the home run is happening all over again.
Oh, boy. What a life. What a life. I remember those things if they were yesterday. The pitch, the time, the fans. And when I heard that tape, I felt how I felt that day and the spirit that I had and the feeling in my body and running around the bases and just thinking about my mother and father, my dad, who trained me and had great interest in me playing baseball. And I think about all of that, my family, my friends, my school, and all of that comes back to my mind.
Could you name a point when you thought you'd fallen in love with baseball?
That's a good question. When I first stepped into Wrigley Field in 1953, the Cubs was on a losing streak, had a 10-game losing streak.
How unusual to have the Cubs on a losing streak.
It was interesting, but I put on the uniform and I couldn't wait to get down and walk on the field just to see the place, you know. That I think I was the first one on the field. I just said, gosh, this is the place I want to be. So I found out later that Mr. Wrigley had an apartment in left field, and I went to look at it. I wanted to stay there. I really did. I didn't want to leave the park. It just captured me. It just grabbed me and said, this is the place you need to be. Like it was talking to me, the park itself. This is your place. This is the place where you do all the things you need to do in the game. And I just fell in love with it.
How did you come to learn how to deal with disappointment?
I guess I was with a writer one time named Herb Cohen. And he would give me little quotes and things, a thing to think about in my life. And he said, well, most things, Ernie, in your life, you care about them, but not that much. So I kind of stuck with my life. I care about it, but not that much. You know, we play a game, we lose. I care about it, but not that much.
Did you ever ask to be traded? Maybe to a team that had won the World Series within anybody's lifetime?
No, I did not. They talked about it, but I didn't think about no trade at all. I just was so focused on playing. When I walked in that ballpark, my mind just, boom, on the game. Because it's a park where you can easily lose your concentration because you're close to the fans and all of that. And, you know, you can see people in the stands walking around, pretty girls and all of that. You can lose your concentration real fast. And I played the game as if nobody was there but me. That was it. When I walk in a ballpark today, I mean, it's the same thing, just me and the ball. And my life is like a miracle. I mean, I don't even know how I got into baseball. And I always felt bad about attention coming my way for some reason. Something happened to me. I do something pretty exciting. I didn't want the spotlight on me. I got an award the other day at the Library of Congress, and I said, gosh, I'm getting an award for doing nothing. I haven't done anything. Nothing.
Well, I think the record book would dispute you there.
No, but me personally, I mean, I always had a bigger goal when I was 15. and that was to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think about that a lot. I dream about it. I see myself in Stockholm. That has been my journey. I mean, I've been chasing the footsteps of my life to do something worthwhile. I've done anything yet. I have not done anything yet.
Once again this year, Ernie Banks did not win the Nobel Prize for Peace. His disappointment is real. And yet as we talk, his cell phone rings, and the ringtone suggests a corner being turned.
Sun is shining, and, you know, it's no... No, it's... That's what I'm going to do, lay down and die.
His ringtone is the 70s disco hit, I Will Survive.
That could be the theme song of the Cubs, I Will Survive.
Ernie Banks survived. He's a father again, at age 79, having adopted a one-year-old girl with his wife. And although he's just passing through this Washington hotel, everybody seems to know him. People stop to shake his hand. After a while, Ernie Banks is greeted by a businessman from Libya. Maybe that Peace Prize is still within reach for a man who told us during our visit that it's possible to win without winning. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.